Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to Lieutenant J. Williams, Royal Navy, talking about HMS Victorious and the British Pacific Force. It was recorded on 5th of April 1974 and duration is 31 minutes.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is John Williams. I left the Navy in December last year, having served 40 years, 30 years in the RN and the last 10 years in the Royal Australian Navy, which was absolutely delightful. Well, I'm here to speak about a magnificent ship known as HMS Victorious, which I am proud to tell you would be one of the happiest, if not the happiest ship I had the privilege of serving in despite the war. We had a magnificent history of cooperation in all branches. Our captain was Captain Michael Maynard Denny, who later became an admiral, full admiral. And I might add that thanks to his skill and seamanlike qualities, he saved that ship on more than one occasion. However, I joined Victorious in mid-1943 when she was refitting in Gladstone Dock in Liverpool. And as you can well understand, Liverpool was being severely battered during those war years. However, Victorious got on with the refit, and when I was off watch, I took the opportunity to get some rest by traveling by train to Chester to see my fiancée. Well, this went on for a couple of weeks, and one afternoon I said, well, I'll see you tomorrow, my dear, 5 o'clock, whatever it was, and 2 years later I kept the date. However, this is not a love story, this is to do with that magnificent ship, Victorious. And having completed the refit, we put to sea and did our workup period based at Scapa Flow. And for the remainder of that year, we carried out various roles. For example, we covered Atlantic convoys. Our aircraft bombed the Tirpitz, who was sheltering in the Norwegian fjord. Very successfully, I might add. And we went to the other extreme and covered a convoy to Russia. On completion of those roles, we returned to Scapa and we were privileged to entertain General Montgomery, who came on board and tell us what the general situation was in the offing. And then he mysteriously disappeared, and we found that the second front was on. However, our next port of call was Trincomalee, where we joined the Eastern Fleet under Admiral Somerville. Allow me to go back 2 years to 1942. The Japanese occupation of Burma in 1942 had deprived the British Eastern Fleet of all its bases in the Indian Ocean, with the exception, of course, of Colombo and Trincomalee, Ceylon. So Even they had to be given up after Japanese raids sank the Hermes, which was a carrier, and two cruisers, the Cornwall and the Dorsetshire. So Admiral Somerville took the fleet to Kilindini. And there he had to operate and try to support the operations in Burma. So at this stage of the war, the Japanese were in full command of the Bay of Bengal. That was the situation. It was not until January 1944 that the Eastern Fleet was back in Ceylon, based at Trincomalee. And during this period, there was a lot of U-boat activity in the Bay of Bengal, both German and Japanese. And as some of us might recall, we had a tragic loss in the sinking of the Khedive Ismail, which was a troop transport, and there were a large number of Wrens, ATS, and nursing sisters who had been relieved and were relieving people on the station. 1,300 lives were lost. There was a shocking shortage of escorts because of the activities in other theatres of war, and despite Admiral Somerville's plea to the Admiralty for more escort vessels, they were a long time coming. Eventually, anyhow, more escorts became available and the U-boat menace was subdued, completely subdued, and we were able to operate again in the Bay of Bengal. At this stage, Admiral Somerville decided to step up the offensive operation in support of operations in Burma. And with this object in view, the Illustrious, another fleet carrier, and the USS Saratoga, which was loaned, or which was operating with the Eastern Fleet from the American Fleet, they carried out operations and inflicted heavy damage in strikes on Sabang, Surabaya, and Wonokromo. Later on, we're coming up now to the 25th of July, 1944, and Admiral Somerville took the whole Eastern Fleet back to Sabang and carried out a bombardment of shore defenses. And there was little or no opposition. Aircraft from Victorious and Illustrious attacked the airfields and caught the Japanese aircraft on the ground. Four battleships, seven cruisers, and 10 destroyers carried out a bombardment of shore defenses from ranges closing from 18,000 yards to 3,000 yards. 18,000 yards to 3,000 yards. What I'm saying is that it was devastating. And not only that, but the Dutch vessel, the Dutch cruiser Tromp, and some destroyers even entered the harbour and used their close-range weapons to even have further chaos. If my memory serves me right, Captain Denny took Victorious in, and a thing unheard of in naval annals was carried out when an aircraft carrier carried out a bombardment with his armament. So the Eastern Fleet at this stage had resumed full maritime control of the Bay of Bengal. And the 14th Army, which it was stated was the largest single army in the world, pressed on, was able to press on to Mandalay, and even beyond that to Rangoon. Because the Japanese anticipated that with the monsoon season coming on, they could get away with it, as it were, and repair their supply line. But this was not to be. At this stage in the war, a change of fleet command took place. That was in August of 1944, when Admiral Somerville was relieved by Admiral Bruce Fraser. But this was only temporary, because in 3 months, Admiral Bruce Fraser was then nominated as the commander of the new British Pacific Fleet, which was to operate with the Americans in the Pacific. And Admiral Bruce Fraser took over the British Pacific Fleet, and Admiral Parr came out to take over the Eastern Fleet. By the beginning of 1945, the aircraft carriers Indomitable, Indefatigable, Illustrious and Victorious had been assembled at Trincomalee under the command of Rear Admiral Carriers, the famous Rear Admiral Byer. And he, to give us some practice, did a few strikes on, he carried out 3 strikes in January on all refineries at Pancallan, Brandon, on the 4th of January, Palembang on the 24th and 29th, and severely damaged the installations, all the oil installations in the area, adding further chaos to the Japanese supply lines in Burma. Well, now the part that the carriers played in the Pacific began. The carriers were then dispatched to Australia to join Admiral Bruce Fraser and his battleships Howe and KG5. This happened in February 1945. At this stage, the American advance in the Pacific had reached the Philippines. Admiral Fraser was present at the Lingang Gulf action, where the kamikaze, the suicide bombers, were first used against the fleet. He was there as a spectator and had his first experience of the Japanese kamikaze bombers, and among other ships sunk or damaged by these kamikazes was the Australia, HMAS Australia. And she sustained 5 hits. 5 hits from the kamikazes. 5 kamikaze planes hit the Australia. She survived these hits, but it revealed the strength and staunchness of British shipbuilding. And Admiral Bruce Fraser's confidence in the strength of British shipbuilding was further enhanced when the carriers were attacked later in the war. During February 1945, the U.S. Marines landed on Iwo Jima. We're now getting close to Japan, getting closer to Tokyo. 750 miles to go. And over 20,000 fanatical Japanese fought to the death. 20,000. Admiral Nimitz wrote of the U.S. Marine Corps, "Uncommon valor has been commonly displayed." They thoroughly deserved it. Well, the next target were the Royal Cuckoos, the Okinawa. It was Okinawa was the next target. The British Pacific Fleet didn't take part in the major actions, but it was engaged in neutralizing Japanese airfields in the Sakishima Islands. For 62 days, the fleet remained at sea, being nourished by the fleet train, which originally was an American concept that they'd adopted 2 years before, which avoided the necessity of ships going into harbor, restoring, refueling, and so on. The fleet train, although it didn't go into the actual action zone, was within sufficient distance for the ships to retire and be replenished. They were supply ships and oil tankers. Inevitably, the fleet, and especially the carriers, attracted the kamikazes. Indefatigable, forgive me, I always called the Indefat, was hit at the base of the island's superstructure. This was on the morning of the 1st of April, 1945. By the afternoon, she was operational again. Another kamikaze bounced off the front of the flight deck of Victorious. Due to the skill at maneuvering the ship by Captain Denny, this kamikaze just bounced off the flight deck and into the sea. And the resultant plume of water was 5 times the height of the flight deck. This picture was taken from a ship ahead. There was no damage, it just exploded harmlessly. During the second series of strikes, that was in May, Formidable and Indomitable were both hit. That was on the 4th. And Victorious and Formidable on the 9th. In each case, the damage was only temporary. As a matter of fact, in Victorious, we caught a kamikaze that hit a Bath B turret. And the result of that, there were 4 killed in B turret and there were 14 injured. Two of these, Lieutenant Jealous, I shouldn't say he shouldn't have been there because his particular action station was Director Oxer, controlling the 2 turrets. But it happened to be in a stage of a sudden attack between, if you understand me, defense stations and action stations. And his defense station was the turret. So if he had been in his proper action station, he would have been all right. But however, he remained at his post. Probably couldn't get up in time, and he was straddling between the 2 turrets. However, he was badly hurt, and as we transferred him to a destroyer to be taken to a medical base, he died. Another gentleman by the name of John Cann, a naval seaman, his normal action station was operating a twin Oerlikon on the starboard side of the island, way up. And his nerves had gone a bit, and he came along the day before and asked for his action station to be changed and the cabin. So we did this, and he was another chap who was killed. However, that's by the way. The damage was only temporary, and all ships were operational within a few hours. A state of affairs that compared favorably. Well, the state of affairs where these kamikaze bombers attacking our carriers, they either bounced off or caused little damage operationally. But this was not the case with American carriers, because they had not adopted the British practice of putting armor plating on their flight deck. So unfortunately, when a kamikaze boy hit an American carrier, he just went through the flight deck and exploded in the hangar. Consequently, the carriers, the American carriers that were hit, were put out of action for a very long period. Others, of course, didn't survive. Well, we move on up the Pacific, and Okinawa was taken on the 21st of June, 1945. And with it, the last hope of Japanese survival perished. In point of fact, at this stage, Japan was a defeated nation. Although through the stubbornness of her leaders, she still refused to accept the fact. There was a huge sea blockade on by the Americans and the British, mostly by the Americans. And although the Japanese had millions of soldiers still in the field, their supply lines were completely cut. And the only way that the economy of Japan was being bolstered at this stage was by a line between through the Sea of Japan to China. Well, American submarines even infiltrated into the Sea of Japan, and in a matter of 9 days, I think, from the 9th of June to the 19th of June, their submarines sank 27 Japanese ships. At this stage, 88% of Japanese shipping had been sunk. And from that time on, the activity of American submarines just went flat, purely because there weren't any more Japanese ships to sink. There weren't any. However, the home islands of Japan were now under constant attack, both by carrier-borne aircraft of the British and US fleets, and also by super fortresses that were now operating from Okinawa, from the airfield on Okinawa. And on the 17th of July, 1945, aircraft from Victorious, Formidable and Implacable raided targets in the Tokyo area. That's how close they were. And the little that remained of the Japanese fleet was destroyed in the carrier raid on Kure from the 24th to 28th of July. It included 3 battleships and 2 carriers sunk, and numerous cruisers and destroyers sunk have been moored. So at that stage, in our opinion, in our humble opinion, the war with the Japanese was over. But on the 6th of August, an aircraft dropped the A-bomb on Hiroshima. Followed, of course, a couple of days later on Nagasaki. Well, with the final surrender of Japan on the 15th of August, Victorious returned to Sydney. We stayed here a month, and then we went home and returned to Sydney after a while to take hundreds of war prisoners back to the United Kingdom. Thank you for your attention, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, thank you, Lieutenant Williams, for a most interesting address. The BPF, as you know, is very dear to our hearts in this society, mainly because of the memorial which we had much pleasure in having erected there at Potts Point. As a matter of fact, in the last 10 days, that memorial came up again. The Naval Board has before it now the acceptance of the memorial. It's rather a strange thing to accept a memorial when it's fixed to a wall, which I think you'd need gelignite to move it. But rather this present time, the Naval Board is considering accepting it from the Society. I now call upon Lieutenant Reg Torrington, our Vice President, to me a vote of thanks on the behalf of our President. Thank you, Reg.
It's my very great pleasure to give this state to my very good friend, John Williams. John and I, we only met a few years ago down at HMAS Catapult, but our paths must have crossed and crisscrossed many times throughout the war, and I'm sure that in places like the Occidental Hotel in Colombo, that we no doubt were in the bar at the same time. It's most interesting to what he says about the relationships within these ships, these carriers. I was served with the carriers first on an escort, and there were four very wonderful carriers. That was the Illustrious, the Victorious, the Formidable, and the Indomitable. Some of the others came later, and of course the Ark Royal was sunk in November 1941. But these four carriers, I think, bore the brunt of the carrier work from throughout the war. I was on an escort one time lightning, and we saw the one we were with was Indomitable. And it's amazing to see the relationship that does bring up between the carrier, its air group, and the escort ships that were with us. I think, as a matter of fact, on lightning we fished about 20 people, 20 aircrew out of the sea at different times when they crashed. So I think there could have been something in that, but in the relationship. With Victorious, it was a most interesting ship. Before John joined it in 1943, it was one of the few RN ships. Earlier in 1942, after Pearl Harbor, when the Americans had suffered such losses, that it was one of the reverse lease lending, and it went on loan to the American Navy for a few months and served in the Pacific, and then returned back to the United Kingdom. I also think it went on the convoy to Malta in 1942. My memory is getting a long time ago. But this was the famous convoy to Malta in August 1942, where they had which the biggest group that the British had operated up to late. The Indomitable was in that group also. And I remember too when I was on the operation, which John mentioned, when they bombed the Turks. This was in early 44. I was on one of the American lease land carriers then, the Spencer, and Victorious had the air crew. We did the anti-submarine patrols, and the Victorious air group from Victorious, which had barracudas, did the strike on the Turks. And it was rather interesting that this large force moved right up to the top of Norway. The purpose was in Orkney Fjord then, and they were able to launch this strike, and purpose, I forget what they were doing, I'm not sure whether they were just falling in for their day's work or whether they were just getting up steam. I think they were just getting up steam to move the ship when the barracudas appeared out of the, over the mountain and made did quite a lot of damage to purpose. So that was Victoria's previous to when John joined her. And after the war, she was had a complete refit, which I think cost something like £7 million, wasn't it?
Right down the keel.
And she then became one of the main carriers in the NATO force, and also acted as radar guard ship. The RN's radar has, I think, even to this day, always been exceptional, and perhaps, I might say, best in the world. Victorious served in this role with NATO forces in the Atlantic for quite a long time. So it's a ship with a very, very fine history, a very, very interesting history. And I would like to thank John Williams on behalf of us all here for telling us a very interesting and worthy story of when he served. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ships' plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.